Oh, I'm hearing that. Something about this jacket is magic, right?
Okay, I'm going to open our House Committee on Agriculture, Natural Resources, and Rural Communities. Today's Tuesday, February 24th, 2009. On today's agenda, you will see three bills. There's a common thread. They're all co-sponsored by the former chair of this committee.
Uh-oh.
So, and they're all actually have to do with veterinarian issues. So you all come up with your own conclusion about how that came about. But I have a feeling that people thought he might be chair again, and they asked him to come sponsor their bills. I don't know. So we're going to start with opening hearing in House Bill 2462. And Representative Roblin, do you want to come up and talk about your bills?
I have to.
For the record, Arne Roblin, State Representative of House District 9, and I want to thank the chair and the committee for hearing these bills. And you are right. A group of people came to me, I think presuming that I might still be with regard in ag and natural resources, but also I think because having been here now for two previous sessions, I had an understanding of the kinds of things we were talking about. And so the first bill, 2462, you know, we expect our vets to be able to take care of animals and to do their job. And they oftentimes sell us things, as in their vet shop, if you have your pet, you can get Frontline, you can get other kinds of stuff for flea and so on. But those are also pesticides. And when they sell them to you, they don't have a requirement necessarily to take care of reporting it. But if they apply it, then they are applying a pesticide. And they have the same requirements that another person would applying pesticides. They're fairly small quantities. They are absorbed through the skin for the most part. There are some new pills that they can give to animals. And sometimes they actually go, when you talk about large vets, they go out to the field and apply to cattle. There are different pesticides that are used. But again, the quantities are very small. And the issue that some of the vets have had is when they've tried to go online and register it, they've had problems getting it all taken care of. It is a frustration to them. They already keep records.
Question, you say go online, you mean into the pesticide use reporting system?
To log on, let them know what they're doing. Yes. They have had some difficulties. From my perspective, as I looked at pesticide use reporting, I did not see this application as one of those that needs to be reported. Because the amount used is so minor. The fact is that most of what they do, they sell, and therefore that's not reported. Now, if it goes on a farm, it may have to. If they're destining their cattle or doing something, that person would have to report it. But actually having the vets report didn't make a lot of sense to me, and I wanted to make sure that they continue to do what they do and not get too frustrated with some of the systems that we've put in place, not necessarily intended for them in the first place. So that's kind of the gist of this bill. And if you have any questions, I'd be glad to answer them.
Got a couple other folks, but if you've got questions for our friend before we send him back up on the other side, we got him here, captive. We got him twice more probably to take a few shots. A
couple more times, yeah.
Representative Krieger.
I never paid attention, or I would have thought of some questions last night.
Me too, yeah.
We got him where we wanted.
Representative Shoffley.
Thank you. Yeah, I read it this morning, and I may think it makes perfect sense to me, Representative. You know, just on pesticide use reporting in general, the people out there using this stuff in hinterland on their fields and forests are all licensed, all educated, all understand the cost and the impact of these chemicals and products, and they're not out there just willy-nilly pouring it on. It's be quite frankly, it's the people in town that aren't licensed, that are irresponsible, use in improper fashion, and it turns into a cesspool of chemicals. That's, I think, where the real problem is. I just had to editorialize there.
Okay.
Thank you, Representative.
I've never. When did this behavior start?
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Krieger.
There was a little sign on the wall by his office that said, Mike Schaffler, and it says Krieger on steroids.
And in response to Representative Shuffler, I was concerned that we're not being able to stick something in about taking a harvest of a few more trees at the same time would put at risk my bills, but I was hopeful that he would come around.
While he brought it up.
No, that's
Representative Van Orme.
Thank
Vice
you,
Chair.
Chair.
Excuse me.
Chair Clem, I know I have my trouble with titles, too. The only other option to this would be not to provide the pesticide to the dog owner like me who has had a dog with mange. Is that correct?
Well, not entirely. They could continue to provide it and sell it. It becomes your problem, not theirs, if you're out on a farm or whatever. The issue is that in their office or when they come and apply it themselves, that's the problem that you might have. So, and I think that having vets do the application in some situations is the best because they really actually do know. And in particular, if they're out at a ranch or a farm working on large animals, I think it's important that they are the ones that are applying it oftentimes. And they know the difference. I mean, that's the issue here.
Follow up. Well, I'd just like to say that it's, as a person who's had a dog with mange and has had to administer pesticide, it was certainly far better than having my uncle shoot my first dog. So I still haven't forgiven him, obviously.
I've never heard of that pesticide application technique.
Yeah, it was.
Thank goodness.
Any questions for our colleague? Okay, thank you. I'm going to call up Glenn Kolb from the Oregon Veterinary Medical Association. Now, before you start, let me just try some reverse psychology today. These bills are all going to be extraordinarily difficult. There's no way we'll get done in time. There's no way we'll be able to do anything on any of them. I'm positive of it. Let's just see if that works better than my normal theory that we're going to just let them all fly. All right.
Well, good morning, Chair Clem, Vice Chair Van Orme, and Vice Chair Krieger, and committee members. For the record, my name is Glenn Kolb. I'm Executive Director with the Oregon Veterinary Medical Association. And this morning I have here with me Dr. Tom Keck, a practitioner from Dallas, Oregon, who may be able to address some of the issues, too. We appreciate Representative Roblin's comments about this bill and appreciate his support on that. You know, when we look about it in veterinary medicine, the application is used in a much smaller way than in a large agricultural sense, which we think was maybe one of the initial intents. Concern about the environment is important. But one example in companion animal practice, when it is used, it is in a very secure location. It's within a building. It's applied small amounts on the back and nape of the neck of a dog or a cat. In many cases, these pesticides now are coming in pill form. And with ear mite medication, you're going to be either squirting it or rubbing it into the ear canal. And these animals then go home, they go in a car, and they go back to the owner's residence. So environmental concerns within the practice, it's already contained. In large animal medicine, there are some uses of pesticides. Representative Roblin had commented on those. You can have either on a little ear tag, and then systemically it starts going into the skin, or a pour on, and Dr. Keck can probably address some of those too. So we're asking for an exemption for the veterinary profession on these products.
Okay. Welcome.
My name is Tom Keck. I'm a practitioner right across the river in Dallas, Oregon. The major problem with what we presently got is a reporting system that is cumbersome, is difficult. That's one thing. Second thing is, in actuality, the veterinarian is doing a very good service to the client and to the animal-owning public by, in most cases, actually, in the case of the small animal products, showing the proper usage of the product in the exam room by putting the first doses on or using those doses of those medications. And we have to think of them as medications. As Rep. Van Orman says, if you don't treat a dog with certain conditions, like mange, it's a nightmare. And if you don't use the product correctly, it's a nightmare. And so this is an educational thing of which if we show them how to do it right the first time, it probably will be done right. If we just hand somebody a package because of a reporting problem and say, have at it, it's going to be misused, and probably you can make a case that you could have more contamination of the environment. because it was would be improperly used. So it is to the benefit of the client, the benefit of the animal, that it be used properly and that the veterinarian or veterinarian's trained staff show how that is done. Out on the farms, the uses of systemic porons, again, a demonstration situation. These things are not cheap. If we use them properly and show how they are to be used, one, it's more economical for the farmers, and two, your exposure to the environment of the product is really minimal by showing the proper technique so it's not wasted and so it doesn't just splatter all over the place. That's really that simple.
Questions for these gentlemen? Representative Krieger.
Ivomec.
Yes.
Use it all the time.
Yep.
It's expensive.
Yep.
So I'm very careful.
Yeah, because
you still have to calculate the weight of the animal.
You got to calculate the weight of the animal and everything, but for crying out loud, you don't want to pour it on the ground because that's $2 or $3 right there per animal. Yeah.
Notice I didn't try to do it. Follow up.
Any other machine gun questions?
We're ready to vote, Mr. Chair.
we have one more member of the public here. Okay. Thank you, gentlemen.
Well, thanks for your time. Appreciate it.
Oh, my gosh. Ame, code, please come up and visit with us. I couldn't remember what the N was for. It's for Northwest.
Yeah. Yes.
Thank you. I was thinking of National? No. Who was that?
Good morning. My name is Ame Code. I work at the Northwest Coalition for Alternatives to Pesticides. I wanted to... Obviously, I'm here to testify on House Bill 2462. I did want to quickly take a moment and thank the committee, and especially Chair Representative Clem for your effort to continue and strengthen pesticide use reporting here in Oregon. You obviously recognize it's a valuable program, and I think that that has been verbalized very clearly by our state's natural resource agencies, who have said this baseline data, the information gathered through PERS, can help make existing programs more effective, more efficient, and more targeted. And programs such as the Pesticide Stewardship Partnership Program and Oregon's Drinking Water Program. So in 1999, Oregon's legislature passed pesticide use reporting, and they recognized the value in a comprehensive program, a program that didn't just look at major uses of pesticides, didn't just look at agricultural use, but looked at the 30% of pesticide use that is a variety of applicators. It is our concern that this bill creates an exemption that could open the door to other minor uses asking for a similar exemption. There is nothing in this, in the statements that were made, that couldn't fit with other groups that also have concerns with pesticide use reporting. Granted, it's a new program. It needs to be smoothed out. You know, there's the end, but that is our concern. I want it to be on the record that NCAP, which is our group, Northwest Coalition for Alternatives to Pesticides, is not opposed to exemptions to pesticide use reporting. We feel that at this time it is premature. We need a few years of contiguous data in hand so that the State Department of Agriculture and the natural resource agencies can determine what are the priorities, what are the issues. Therefore, they can select and determine what are the exemptions that need to be made. And that's really our one concern with this bill.
Questions? Representative Roblin.
I will ask a question. I guess my because I do think that what we've done with pesticide use reporting is important, and I would like to keep doing it. When you have these such small amounts that are being put on, I doubt that they actually even show up, and it creates some of the other kinds of problems. So from my perspective, I think if we don't go about doing things that seem to be rational, we end up having a chance to lose the whole thing. And it's the same issues that have to do with land use and other things. When things look really out of place, and most people look at them and say, why are we doing this? Then they start thinking the whole program is of no value. And I'm hearing a bigger and bigger discussion about we don't need pesticide use reporting, we need better collection of data in rivers and streams to find out what's actually there. So what would be your response to that? I mean, that's the concern that I have here.
So you made two...
So there's three questions.
Yeah, okay, I only followed two of them, so you better help me with the third.
He's known for this.
He's good. I've heard him. I know. I respect him for that, so I'll watch my words. To answer the last question first, in order to monitor our rivers and streams, we need baseline information. If we don't know what's being used, we don't know what to monitor for. You know, it is extremely expensive to monitor. You look at monitoring for DEQ monitors, a couple of sites a year for 15 different pesticides. They're spending for each site two tests. They're looking at $30,000 to $40,000. And they don't even know if those are pesticides that are necessarily being used within those waterways, near those waterways. So pesticide use reporting absolutely is baseline information to target and make that more effective, and it's a lot less expensive than monitoring on its own. I absolutely hear your issue of let's not worry about that last 5% of pesticide use. Let's look at the major uses. The problem is we don't have a complete view right now to know which ones are the ones of concern. I could go into the research on, you know, flea and tick treatments and concerns for washing into waterways, you know, most of it through pet grooming. There's different things, but that's not what I'm here. My issue is not with the veterinary uses. It's the fact that we don't have a complete picture. We don't know what are the appropriate exemptions to take at this time. But I absolutely support exemptions with a better picture.
Senator Schaffler.
Thank you. I voted for the pesticide use reporting system funding last session.
Thank you.
I'm not against pesticide reporting system. I do share your concern about the slippery slope phenomenon. We certainly don't want to just willy-nilly exempt people. I support this exemption. I think it makes sense, and to allude to my friend to the right here. There are way more monitoring going on than just that. I still sit on the Sunrise Water Authority Budget Committee. My water district is mandated to consistently, frequently monitor the quality of that water. Mm-hmm. It comes out of wells and out of the Clackamas River. Mm-hmm. And we have to. We are mandated to meet federal standards. And if there is ever, if anything shows up in there that is currently against those standards, I'm confident we'll find the source and we'll take care of it and it'll be done. Otherwise, they'd have to shut the water off, and that would not be good. So this idea that, and I'm not suggesting you are implying this, but this idea that we are willy-nilly consuming water that is not being monitored is just simply not true. And I've said this time and again, no one cares more about the quality of that water than those that drink out of that well. And that would be my friends in agriculture that actually use this stuff judiciously, prudently, properly, accurately. And I'm going to repeat what I just said. It ain't the farmers and the loggers and the veterinarians and the livestock owners. It's the cesspools in the city. And oddly enough, that's where the most complaints come from. And I think we need to clean up our own backyard first before we go after those that are properly using it. That's just my opinion. But we're monitoring water quality all over this country daily. And before anybody out there watching thinks that, oh, my God, they're not monitoring my water, there may be poison in it. Well, that's just not true.
I'm sorry if I misled. I was making the clarity just that looking at if you go to one site, and obviously DEQ, U.S. Geological Survey, you know, all the different drinking water sources, they're all doing monitoring, but the expense of monitoring and without knowledge of baseline information on what's being used is less targeted.
And one more follow-up, Mr. Chair.
Yeah,
if we wait till we get the complete picture, we'll never do anything in this world, ever. And we're never going to get the complete picture. Just this idea that we have to somehow wait for everything until everyone's satisfied that we have the complete picture, not in just this issue, but a wide range of anything, that's it's just not going to happen. And that strategy is used to obstruct, delay, prevent, and deny progress and moving forward in this world, and it frustrates me to no end. So we're never going to have the complete picture. But God bless you. I'm glad you're here adding tension to this system because we will get a better product because of your presence.
Representative Schaffler, I think you forgot something. She's a fine American.
I'm a fine American.
His office game. Did you? Any response? Are you good at the moment?
No. Thank you very much.
Representative Roble.
Just a comment. I was on pesticide use reporting, and as Representative Shoffler and most of us did, we voted for the money to do that stuff last time, and I am excited about doing some of that. But one of the other interesting things, the people who ask the most for the results of where the pesticides, what are being used, happens to be the companies that sell pesticides, because they want to find out whose customers are where. And it's been really interesting lately how, you know, a lot of people thought they were going to try to figure out, people would be crazy about where it's at, what's going on. Those aren't the people that are asking. The people who are asking are the same companies that are making and providing pesticides, because they now know where theirs and competitors' stuff is being applied. I find that interesting.
That is interesting. Okay. So, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2462 and open a work session on House Bill 2462. Discussion. Representative Vice Chair Van Orman.
Thank you, Chair Clem. I have a question for Representative Shoffler.
Yes, ma'am.
When you mentioned the homeowner use, my impression was that that is a particular use that is exempted from pesticide reporting.
Homeowners don't report anything.
There's.
I just want to make sure I understood that.
Yeah, there's a survey that's done on an aggregate sort of level by the department.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, nodding heads. Yes, that is done of residential use, but it's not done the same way it is for a commercial applicator, where you actually go and log in and put yours in. But yes, it is still collected. You could, you know, debate the accuracy of sampling and all that stuff, but yes,
okay.
There is a survey on homeowners.
Okay, thanks.
And Mr. Chair, if I hire a professional applicator, I believe they are obligated to report.
Mm-hmm.
But I, as the homeowner, can go out and buy 10 gallons of Crossbow and dump it all over the place. Now, I'd never do that.
That is correct.
But
you have an ally in the audience on dealing with that issue.
And priority, ironically enough, my wife's name is Frances Sunseri, and they pulled her randomly out of the phone book, and she was part of the survey.
Was that right?
They phoned us every so many months or weeks, was part of that survey, which I'm glad they're doing.
Further discussion. Okay. So just the one comment I would make, and this applies to this, but I always try and get this out sometime somewhere. No one ever seems to have it resonate with them, but I'm going to try it again anyway. When I was in my philosophy class in college, the slippery slope was called a fallacy of logic. It was a fallacy. And the reason is, just because one thing happens, it doesn't necessarily lead to the other things. Now, when I've told this to my fellow NRA members, it doesn't usually go over so well, and they get really mad. But it's still a fallacy of logic. Just technically, that's all I'm saying. Technically, it doesn't mean that just because one, it leads to the other. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, that's why the correct term is camel's nose under the tent. Not
Yeah, that wasn't in class. I don't the straw man, the ad hominem.
That is infallible logic.
And to go along with that same deal, I am concerned when you don't take some of these and make the exemptions, people get very more and more frustrated. And so it isn't a slippery slope, it's a cliff, because you get ballot measures and other things that come out and say, you're not being reasonable in the application of this stuff with things that don't make any sense. And so I worry that it doesn't start a slippery slope. It starts people getting upset over time, talking to lots of other people, they getting upset and not understanding why we would have done this. So that's part of why I look forward to doing it.
Yeah, I skipped class today. They talked about that one.
Yeah, I know.
Okay.
But, Mr. Chair, I was enjoying listening to Representative Shoffler talking about slippery slopes and willy-nilly. I mean, this is not a discussion I expected to have today. So the definition of willy-nilly is...
There's always discussions that nobody was thinking were going to happen.
Especially in this committee.
And one that we thought we were going to have today about the Marionberry that all 90 of us signed on to, but unfortunately the sponsor of the bill said that bill's now dead, and please pull it from the committee. So we can talk about that later. You never know what's going to happen in this committee.
I say we move it.
Which is why the business lobby wants all bills referred here, I notice. Corporate minimum, health care, they seem to want them all.
Laurie, can you tell Dave? No. No. Not that. All right.
We're in a work session on this bill. I'm sorry. I'm getting us out of line. Is there any more discussion?
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2462 to the floor with due pass recommendation.
Representative Schaffler moves House Bill 2462 with the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any further discussion? Will the clerk call the roll?
Representative Byer.
Aye.
Representative Wingert.
Aye.
Vice Chair Van Orman.
Aye.
Vice Chair Krieger.
Aye.
Representative Shaw.
Aye.
Representative Healy.
Aye.
Representative Robin.
Aye.
Chair Clem.
Aye. Motion passes. Representative Robin, would you like to carry...
I could. I'd be glad.
Carry your bill?
Yeah. I'd be glad to.
Okay. Now I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2496. Want to do it from down there, up here? What's your preference?
It's so much fun to stand and see all of you.
Sure, it's a real joy.
Trying to grandstand.
For the record, I am State Representative Arne Roblin from House District 9, and 2496 is a bill that came to me from a constituent in Florence who runs the Humane Society building there and a little thrift shop and stuff so that they can keep it running. And he had thought that they should be able to get a tax exemption because other businesses doing that, and he read the bill and realized that public nonprofits which take care of human beings get an exemption, but those that take care of pets do not. And so they have tax that they have to pay to the counties. And I'm somewhat conflicted, and I'll tell you that, because I have real issues with regard to taking the tax base away from counties and so on. So this is a difficult bill, but I felt obligated to at least have the conversation, and I have not been able to get an answer as to what this would actually cost. So that's there. There's a subsequent referral, and I think they need to figure that out. It's something we have tried not to do in the last number of years, and I think the counties may be here to talk about that because they have talked to me, and I agree that going this route with tax exemptions is not my preferred way about going about this kind of stuff, but I didn't see another option to help some of these very small communities that do have people who come up with nonprofits to take care of animals and to try to figure out how to get money in from local vets and others to do spay and neutering and all the kinds of things that we really do need to have in our communities to keep us safe from pets and other animals that get out. You know, the dogs and the cats that get picked up and so on and so forth and need to be taken care of appropriately. These are the groups that do that. And so not coming up with another option, recognizing many of these are on very tight budgets. This is not the National Humane Society. This is the local little people that are in your communities. I figured I would at least have the conversation and figure out where we go from there. So that's the origin of it and what we're talking about. And if there's any questions, I'd be glad to answer them.
We also have someone from the Oregon Humane Society coming up next, but questions for Representative Rowe. Representative Krieger. Vice Chair Krieger.
Representative Roblin. I always want to call you Arnie. I don't know.
That's okay.
As we go through going home, often right there in downtown Coos Bay, they got a lot, and they got the I think it's a local Humane Society does fundraiser there, and they try to. Is that the type of group?
That's the kind of group we have. Many of our counties have these nonprofit groups that take care of people, and they're really run in your local area. They are manned and run, and people, and they are local organizations. That's the groups we're talking about.
Representative Schaffler.
Thank you. Yeah, I think it's a great concept, and they run on a shoestring, and they do provide us with a service that we all want, and it's our money. But my question is, why the July 2002 retrospective effective date? Is there a reason behind
it? Yeah, on this particular one, it had to do with a group that realized that they owe that tax all the way back to there, and they are they're deciding whether or not they're going to make it or not when they pay that all back, because they had assumed they had a
exemption. On that, Mr. Chair,
if
we do that, then all of them will be...
That's true. This bill would make them all, so that's the another part of the issue.
Would there be a follow-up, Mr. Chair?
Yeah, Representative.
Would there be a credit allotted to everybody else then? How would they...
In this particular case, I think that's what would... I would assume that's probably what's going to happen. I don't know the answer to that. That's why I've been waiting to hear what revenue has to say with regard to how this affects things.
Representative Wingard.
Well, I'm just wondering, Mr. Chair, how you'd get a credit when you've been relieved of your tax obligation on a permanent basis. Ultimately, you have to get a refund.
Right. That's that would be the issue.
Because there's nothing to get a credit against.
Yep. And that's another part of the bill that may have to go away. I mean, that's another part of that, and I'm open to any and all of it. But.
Okay. Vice Chair Van Orman.
Thank you, Chair Clem. I'm not sure I have a question in here, but I, you know, having been a city commissioner for 10 years and living in a city that has a huge chunk of exempt property and having all of the areas outside that more and more property became exempted, and then it falls back to the individual homeowner to pick up the difference. I, too, am conflicted because, you know, and I guess one of the things is that we don't have an inventory to know really what the effect of this will be. Is that and
that's true from my perspective. I do not have the inventory. Maybe the people here would have a better idea that for coming up after me on that question.
And
we've tried to figure that out, and I have not been able to get those answers.
So, yeah.
And when we talked about the Humane Society, somehow I got the impression that they had exemption, like the one in Portland.
Yeah. They're here, and they'll be talking next.
Okay. All right. Well, that will
and
my
some
question.
Of these are if you read the bill, it doesn't say Humane Society. It says local that take care of animals in that way. And part of it is some of them are just organizations which take care of that aren't necessarily affiliated with the Humane Society. Yeah. So we'll have to check on that and see.
Will puppy mills fall into this?
No. I would hope not. That's a good question, though. My understanding is not. But
more than we first think.
I'm done.
Representative Gilliam, no problem.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for being here today. You don't have written testimony, so I'm sorry.
I did that because it gave you the opportunity to ask questions more.
And I just was trying to get a name. I'm sorry. You are.
I can't remember.
Oh, Representative Arnie Roblin.
Yes, Representative. I appreciate you acknowledging no fiscal and that it's a bad climate for this. I also am conflicted because of the reverse. I mean, in a bad economic climate, we also need to be mindful of what role our nonprofits play in providing services. So I don't want to just write this off because, you know, we've got a bad financial situation. But to understand it, you said the first part's for those benefiting animals, but the second part... welfare programs would be everybody. Anybody that's a... Is welfare program basically a nonprofit?
Yeah, it's broad sense.
My assumption is yes, but I'll have to go back and check on that one a little bit further. And the other thing, if people, you know, were to find animals, say, out in the wilderness, and they would take them to these places, it would probably solve a lot of problems that we wouldn't have had to deal with last session.
Follow up.
Representative Gilliam.
That's an open
I'm going to ignore that and ask you this. What would, so we say, we authorize property tax exemption, permit them to apply. Do we have, is this just helping to clear the way? Why couldn't they apply now?
Well, there is no exemption to apply for, so it would be,
they
I mean,
can't
they could
apply. Now.
They could apply, but there is no exemption that we have currently.
My
understanding is that there is not one. Now, we may hear some different things, but my assumption is that once this is out, people don't have to take it. They may feel that they didn't want to do that. But.
Representative Roblin.
Yes.
If I'm not mistaken, I think what's happened here is welfare program is the language used in the existing statute,
okay,
but it hadn't been ever defined, and legislative council took the opportunity to define it, even though this bill actually doesn't invoke it, in order to then invoke animal welfare, which is the same exact definition
thank
of
you
the word animal.
Okay.
Yep, leave it in place. Thank you. So our able committee administrator also reminds me that they actually just moved it from, deleted it from lines 14 through 16 and then just put it
back
in
the other place.
So it's my error. It had been defined. It was not somebody's error in the past. It's my error.
But it's really nice to have our new committee administrator here today to help. She took care of me a lot in the past.
Any other questions for our colleague before we hear from Sharon Harmon, Oregon Humane Society?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and all of the committee for being so patient with me.
Maybe we'll see you again in 10 minutes.
Might be.
All right. Sharon. George, you coming? No? Yep. Okay.
Before she sits down, Mr. Chair, do you still have a German Shepherd?
I have two now.
I just want to say she was nice enough to give my daughter and her little cousin and little friends a tour of the Humane Society a couple years ago, and that was very generous of you, and I appreciate it. And they wanted to take every puppy and kitty home with them, but fortunately we avoided that. But
you didn't take any?
I met the German Shepherd this summer.
You did take
He might have been able to meet my dog, but he's been banned from the Capitol.
And as a person who's allergic to dogs, I do appreciate the fact that you've kept them home. Thank you.
You didn't have to come to my office. Okay.
They contaminate the environment.
All right, then. All right, then. Welcome.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm a little nervous testifying this morning. I've learned philosophy lessons, added willy-nilly to the state lexicon.
But we did not denote a state berry today, nor will we.
We didn't discuss the state berry.
But sure, now she said lexicon, not leprechaun.
Okay, all right.
Yell everybody out of order, but I have to start with myself. I'm not sure that's within the rules, so I'm just going to let you talk.
I'll just start then. Thank you for the opportunity to testify on behalf of this bill. I'm Sharon Harmon, Executive Director of the Oregon Humane Society. We are a local animal welfare organization. We're not connected to any national group or any local organization within Oregon. For instance, we're not affiliated with the Florence Area Humane Society. We've been around since 1868. We have about 50,000 supporters across Oregon and actually across the country. I would like to declare a non-conflict of interest. We do not have a thrift store. We have one facility in Portland, Oregon, and this bill would not benefit us in any way. But it does benefit, it has the potential to benefit many shelters across Oregon. Grants Pass, Salem, Redmond, Bend, certainly Florence runs a fine facility, and along with you, I'm a little mystified as to how many others are out there, and that might be hard to figure out. I couldn't even tell you how many shelters there are in Oregon, which brings me to my first point is I'm concerned if we classify an animal welfare program that it's so hard these days to tell the difference between a rescue, a humane society, a shelter, and a hoarder. And I just want to caution, I want to caution the committee that what we put in as a definition, that we're really clear what it benefits, and who it benefits. And the intent is, and thanks to Representative Roblin, very meritorious, there's nobody better than a nonprofit at getting the last value out of a dollar. No doubt about it. And the folks in Florence do a fabulous job. They went from a group of foster homes to a very nice facility and one big step, and they continue to provide invaluable service to the community by humane societies across Oregon. We just have to make sure that if we're going to use revenue from Oregon, that we benefit Oregon's animals. And I'd like to see that this bill be restricted to animal programs in Oregon, such that, for example, some group from Utah could come, set up a retail store, and send all the money to Utah or wherever else they send it. If we don't restrict it to 501c3s, the federal IRS code, we open the door to lobbying organizations, PACs, setting up a retail store, getting donated stuff, and then sending that money back to your committee. I'm sure that would not appeal to you as well. It doesn't appeal to me either. We think that groups like the Florence Area Humane Society and the Bend Humane Society of Central Oregon really do an excellent job. And I think those are the folks you think of when you think of who should benefit from this bill. And I would just ask that it be tweaked a little to reflect that, you know, we're going to give up some money. These nonprofits are going to turn it into gold protecting animals. But let's make sure it stays in Oregon and it stays in the programs that you value the most. The last point I want to make is that there's I couldn't reconcile between animal welfare programs provided it for free and the function of the retail store. Does that mean that the retail store could only be exempt of all the programs at the animal welfare agency were at no charge? Because we all charge adoption fees and we're sticklers to the law. So if you get a service that can't be a donation, you get a product like a cat. Too bad I failed Representative Shoffler in getting you any animals. I wasn't on my game that day.
We had four adopted animals, Mr. Chair, just for the record.
I got a severe talking to that you left empty-handed. So, you know, so that little bit of it, I just am worried about that definition, and I want to make sure that it hits your target of enabling nonprofits to help communities because government can't provide the service that communities need. That's what nonprofits do. And animal shelters, they do it all, and they do it well, and they do it because they got strong volunteer support, donations from the community, and they make every dollar go the last mile. So thank you for your intent to provide this. We look forward to, if we could provide any assistance, we'd love to help. Thank you.
Representative Vice Chair Van Orman.
Thank you, Chair Clem. I like the idea that we want to define them by 501, being a 501c3. And it's my understanding that if you do have a business that supports it, it falls under a different category than the 501c3.
Representative Kuhn, Vice Chair Van Orman, you might be thinking of unrelated business income tax, but as long as you are within your mission and within the category of which your articles of incorporation are established,
you can go ahead and sell.
You can sell, but right now I'm unclear as to whether this law is universally applied across Oregon. Seems like some counties are a little more lenient than others.
Well, I was follow up.
Yes,
but I was thinking primarily of the federal code, the IRS code, and that if you have the 501c3 is basically to declare that you're a nonprofit, but if you go into a profit-making enterprise, such as selling products, as an aside to the business of the nonprofit, I thought that you would fall under a different classification in the IRS code.
Representative Clemmer, Vice Chair Van Orman, I'm not an attorney, and
well, I'm not either.
And I've certainly experienced in nonprofits, but we could, for example, we could open a doggy daycare center. But we and still be under our 501c3. It's related to our mission, but we would probably have to pay unrelated business income tax on the whatever
right.
profit we made.
Right.
But we would still be a 501c3. If we were going to open a car dealership, that would be a different story.
Okay.
Representative Roblin.
I just want to say thank you because as I read these bills sometimes, and I don't have the expertise with regard to that. We checked around. We're having a hard time finding out where these places existed and what they were. I would love to work with her in an offline, in an informal work group to try to figure out if we can find amendments that would make it clear. So, if that's any help.
Yeah, sounds good. I've got
need a lawyer
two questions. So, if just to make sure I understand it right, like the Salem one, my wife goes down there all the time. If that were housed on the property instead of downtown, out at the actual Humane Society deal out on Turner Road, whatever it is, but the facility where the shelter is, and they did the thrift shop out of there, this wouldn't even be an issue.
Representative Clem, you'd have to ask the State Revenue Office for that advice, but I think it would be more clear that it's still part of the organization. I think where it gets difficult to determine is when it's a separate property and it doesn't involve the core programs of the agency. It simply is a funding vehicle for that agency.
Yeah, interesting. I'll tell you, when I go to my for-profit doctor who works in the confines of the nonprofit Salem Hospital, I always sort of wonder exactly about this whole mix. Now, I'm glad the hospitals, the OMA, are now about to run in the room. I have a couple more questions. I'm sorry. I know you were not here on this topic, but Vicki, don't we use the term Oregon-based to get at Oregon in the Oregon Opportunity Grant Program? Yeah, so there's some language in the Oregon Opportunity Grant statute that helps define how you, you know, reward people for having their headquarters here and not elsewhere, and competing with our Oregon-headquartered companies, which I like that language a lot. Just as a hint for the work group. Yep. Vice Chair Van Orman.
Thank you, Chair Clem. Well, I guess I want to say that I want to be sure that it's restrictive enough so that it really takes in the 501c3s, but it just doesn't open the door for anybody, because I'm taking care of cats right now, too, and they're not mine. But and so it goes.
I think Representative Roman has that on his list of things to do with.
Mr. Chair, I just wanted to thank you for testifying, because you raised a lot of the questions that were running through my mind when you start talking about qualified and welfare programs. So I do appreciate that, and I appreciate us taking a little longer look at this.
I agree.
Okay. Nobody. Oh, Representative Gilliam.
Thank you. Are you feeling well?
I'm feeling better, thank you.
You are on fire today. I just wondered.
I was down over the weekend. I'm back.
Wow. Thank you for coming. did you spend the night? Because, you know, you've been in this building a lot. I appreciate you coming back again today. We were in puppy hearings last night. And I just would offer this caution. You know, you said maybe we should get this defined 501c3 to be, and I think that's a very good point, but you also had a kind of a throwaway line, and you said, you know, lobbying groups could be part of this. And I just want to remind you, in these times, lobbyists are hurting too. I have a lobbyist in my family, and lobbyists are animals too. I just want that on record. Thank you.
Did you declare your conflict of interest? Well,
right? Yeah. But we're not interested in adopting any.
Strike two.
Okay, I'm going to close this public hearing. Thank you.
Thank you.
Man, that took a while. I don't know why.
Okay. We're going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2574. Now, is there anyone who would like to come and...
I'll go down in front. That's
okay.
I feel really bad that Representative Gilliam walked out.
Oh, I know. But...
Oh, my gosh.
He's probably finishing whatever he had to do the first 15 minutes of our committee meeting that he was gone.
For the record, Representative Arne Roblin from House District 9. Thank you, Chair Clem and committee, for hearing House Bill 2574, which relates to a loan repayment program similar to that we have for doctors for, I always like to say, large animal veterinarians. It's really about those veterinarians that are really taking care of our food supply and are very, very important to food security in our country. We have a difficult time recruiting and keeping those veterinarians right now. There is a continuing disparity between the numbers we need and the numbers of vets that are being produced. And so, as we did with some rural doctors, from my perspective, it is important that we start trying to find ways to ensure the proper supply of those valuable resources, i.e. medically trained veterinarians for these large animals. And a number of these doctors, not only these veterinarians, not only work with the large animals, but they help the smaller animals in their local communities. But most of them, actually they're all over the state. We have a very diverse agricultural community in the state that exists in every county. And so having people who have the expertise to work in this field is very, very important. When when we were looking at where we house this, the only place that seems to do this is the OSAC. You see some people in the building. I did talk to them today and said thanks for being there. You notice that I had another bill that was going to try to move the medical one to the rural, but we looked all over and we couldn't find a place that this would really go. I guess we could talk to the rural health people, but that was slightly a different one. And I think I feel comfortable that the people at OSAC can handle this program and do a good job with it. If we had a place that was more directly related, and we thought about that, that might be appropriate as well. But the idea is the same one that we have for doctors. It is taking an understanding that we need to encourage people to get this training and become veterinarians in our state. So with that, I'll answer any questions, and we have some people coming by, and I'll...
Yes, and just to give people a heads up of what's coming, we have 7 members of the public to testify and answer other questions as well. Representative Shoffler.
Just 2, Oregon Student Assistant Commission, is that...
Okay? Yes.
Just so I'm supportive of this concept too, but how much is this going to cost, and where's the money going to come from?
Yeah, this one, as in the others, there isn't an amount in here right now, and eventually we'll have to have that conversation as well. As you know, this sets up the place for it to happen. It puts the structure in, and then with tight resources, we're going to have to figure that out.
And I might just take a moment. This is probably the first a test of the speaker's theory of making the policy committees be more responsible. So I thought about this, and I thought, well, we could just send it down to Ways and Means. And I thought, no, we're not supposed to do that anymore. We're supposed to hoard our bills with, and we don't yet have the fiscal impact statement, but we're supposed to get it. We're supposed to know it. We're supposed to think about all the other things that we might send down there. So we'll hold this, and we'll set it up against other things and figure out what we really want to have happen. And if we do that, the things we send down there have a greater chance of passing, supposedly.
So. And in response to that, my goal would be, at some point, if it looks as if this bill is going to have a fiscal, I would look at trying to take out the things that it wouldn't cost anything and put the policy in. If we can agree on the policy, getting that in place, ready to accept funds in the future, I think is good policy if we believe in the idea.
Vice Chair Van Orman.
Thank you, Chair Clem. It would be my impression that we're really basically talking about Eastern Oregon.
I think you'd probably be incorrect. I think that's a part of it, but you've got Southern Oregon. We have dairy farms and others that that do that. You've got the whole Willamette Valley, which depending on particular years and depending on where the market is, we see people coming and going. We have ranges where they move cattle from one part of the state to the other for feed and other kinds of issues, so the valley does end up having cattle production going on here and other large animals. You see up and down the valley sheep and others. So, I mean, it really all places, I think, in the state can benefit from it.
I have a shortage.
I think, I don't know if we borrow the exact same definition of resource shortage, because it's really specific to veterinary. But for example, you know, I've had people talk to me. There he's just in time to hear this about on rural health. It was a nurse. She was thinking about moving to Silverton. Unclear whether that counted as a rural town, and it's a town in flux. So I don't know for the purposes of rural nursing if Silverton counted or not under the definitions of rural nurse. No, it doesn't. So there is a question if we were going to get into this deeper. We're not going to work it today. We don't have a fiscal. But if we were, we probably could spend time defining
conversation about rural.
You know, where the places would or would not be if you have questions about specific types of things.
Clearly, the rural areas, the farther out, have the biggest problem.
Okay.
Just as we have been finding with doctor shortages.
Okay. Thank you.
Well, and I have a question probably that's better suited for someone else testifying, but I'm wondering if it's a shortage or an imbalance.
Actually, in this one, I think my understanding is that it is actually a shortage. Let's see if I can go. In Oregon, the number is close. 11% of our veterinarians engage in food supply medicine. So it's a fairly small number, and we expect the demand to fall short 4 or 5% a year ongoing.
Okay.
So it is a shortage
of the food supply
veterinarians. That's the vets that are working on all of the large animals.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So in my mind, that tells me maybe there is an imbalance in the practice.
Oh, okay. In the practice itself, I think that may be true.
Okay, we've got a long list. We can see what other questions pop up. Thank you, Representative.
Thank you very much.
So, why don't I have Glenn Kolb? Well, I have three. We'll just have three come up at once. So, Glenn Kolb, Susan Tornquist, and Sharon Harmon again.
Well, thank
Welcome
you again.
Back.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, committee members. For the record, my name is Glenn Kolb. I'm Executive Director with the Oregon Veterinary Medical Association, and we were a supporter or introducer of this House Bill 2574 and appreciate Representative Roblin's support and also Senator Whitsitt's support in being sponsors of this. A couple things that was talked about is this bill. What we like about it, it says, as used in this section, a veterinary resource shortage area. So it doesn't specifically say rural necessarily, because it depends on the time of, it could be in the southern Oregon coast, it could be in the north Oregon coast, it can be in eastern Oregon too. So there are many places where this shortage might show up, and so we like that language that addresses that, and it does talk specifically about large animal veterinary services. We have a concern nationally as well as in Oregon about the shortage of veterinary food supply practitioners. Studies have continued to indicate that increase in demand of services are going up and decline of veterinarians going into this area of practice are declining. So that is one of the concerns. In Oregon nationally, we're looking at about 17% of veterinarians work in this area, but in Oregon, when we looked at our numbers of our membership and non-membership based and practices, that drops down to 11%. Even of that 11%, there are many who are in a mixed animal practice where you might have one person working doing a fair amount of the large animal. You have others doing small animal work. But even in mixed animal practice, sometimes you'll have an imbalance. You'll say it'll be 70% companion animal and 30% large animal. 15% of that might be equine medicine too, so those numbers might even be a little bit smaller in real application in food supply veterinary medicine. One thing we have discussed, there is actually a dollar amount in this bill. It's $20,000 per year, and this legislation is modeled after similar bills nationally. Kansas comes to mind, which has passed legislation. Illinois has passed legislation. Missouri has also done that. It was never our intent, actually, to have it limited to just a $20,000. And we have some suggested amendments to actually increase that amount. Kind of difficult to do, understanding the economic hardships facing the state. But when we talk with veterinary graduates, $20,000 one time is not really much of an inducement for them to look into other, possibly relocating to an area, especially when you consider the penalties in the bill, too. Their concern is that most likely they wouldn't even apply for this. And so our amendment, we have some suggested language that I think you have and we've got here, would be go up to $60,000 total amount. And then Dr. Tornquist was going to actually talk about the student debt load and how that relates.
Okay. Welcome.
Thank you. Questions?
Any questions for him? Representative Shoffler.
And maybe for the whole panel, I'm not really quite sure who to address this to, but food animal would be, you know, cattle, hogs, et cetera. But Clackamas County, I understand, we have like the seventh largest as far as counties per county, I understand we have like something like the seventh largest horse population of any county in the country. And right in my neighborhood, there's people that own llamas, so I'd imagine that would be considered a large animal. Is there a shortage of veterinarians in Oregon? Clearly, in certain areas where there's none, but like where I live, is there a shortage of vet? And we have dense urban in Clackamas County and very rural parts. So,
yeah, Chair Clem, Representative Schaffler, there are areas in the state where there are shortages of veterinarians practicing, again, food supply, veterinary medicine. Eastern Oregon, their concerns, especially when I've talked with some of the veterinarians there who are starting to get closer to retirement, they're trying to look at who is going to come in and start practicing to keep that business going to supply the need of cattle industry in northeastern Oregon and far eastern Oregon in the Burns area would be one example. Relative to the Willamette Valley and llamas, there may or may not be. That I don't know. I think what it does in this bill, too, it talks about coordinating this and having it at kind of in some ways the discretion of the state veterinarian through the Oregon Department of Agriculture determine which areas have those shortages. And we like that idea, too, just that we have close contact with Dr. Don Hansen, and it's just his knowledge of the large animal community, livestock concerns and needs. So we think that would adequately at least address which shortage areas there really are.
Thank you. I'm Dr. Susan Tornquist. I'm the Associate Dean for Student and Academic Affairs at the College of Veterinary Medicine at Oregon State University. I'm very pleased to be here today to address this bill, and I've given you some information with lots of facts and figures, and sort of in answer to some of the questions on the back of that is this map, which shows the counties in Oregon and the relative number of food animal supply veterinarians per county. So that may help. The AVMA, the American Veterinary Medical Association, has compiled all this information for each state. Oregon is not the only state that has a shortage of food supply veterinarians. 13 other states have instituted programs like the one that we're talking about to help with student loan repayment for food animal veterinarians. And I would point out that horses in the United States are not considered food animals. Nor are llamas, no alpacas.
I think he meant big animals. Yeah. The same thing. Like, oh, no, where's he going with this?
And it's a good distinction, actually, because while there may be shortage of veterinarians in some areas for equine veterinarians and companion animal veterinarians, this bill is not addressing those. It's specifically for the food supply veterinarians. So this shortage of food supply veterinarians is been taking on increased significance. I've been a veterinarian for 25 years. It's only about the last 5 years that we've really been looking at this increasing shortage of veterinarians who are trained and willing to work with a food supply, not only the animals, but infectious diseases that are spread from animals to humans. And I think we're all familiar with zoonotic diseases, avian influenza, West Nile virus, tuberculosis. Veterinarians that want to go into areas that deal with those types of issues are not available in the numbers that we need. And a recent report just came out last week. I mentioned it in this handout. About 30% of the veterinarians who currently work in those areas are eligible to retire in the next 3 years. So a few numbers about our students and how indebted they are. We graduate between 47 and 50 students from our program per year. About 65% of those stay in Oregon. Annual fees are listed on the sheet, around $17,000 for residents, $33,000 for non-residents. And the next bullet point is sort of the big picture. The average indebtedness for our graduates currently is $115,000. And there are always some students who don't have any educational debt. This is just for professional school, though, so this doesn't include undergraduate education, and all our graduates also have at least a bachelor's degree. So $115,000, and then you drop down and see what the average starting salary is. Average about $60,000, with women averaging about $55,000. They now make up 80% of our classes. And the median for large animal veterinarians Starting salary is about $61,000, and for mixed animal practitioners, quite a bit lower, $52,000. So you can see that our students graduate with quite a bit of debt and nowhere near the salary on starting out that other professions who have similar educational roads have to follow. So, and again, finally, there are about close to 30% of our graduates every year want to go into large animal practice, specifically food animal or mixed animal practice. Many of those do have that as a plan. They get out there, they practice for 1 year in maybe a remote type of area and realize that the salary compensation is maybe not doesn't make up for some of the disadvantages of where they practice. So we do have students going into rural areas and practicing often for maybe a year or two, and then they move. That's a pattern I see time and again. And again, you've got the map with that shows you there are actually four counties in Oregon that have no food animal veterinarians. And then there's counties. Morrill County kind of stands out. There's one veterinarian for every 112,000 food animals. So if you think about your job as a large animal veterinarian taking care of 112,000 animals, that's kind of daunting, and it's not surprising that graduates are not rushing to take that on. And so my last point is that there's been a lot of conversation in the veterinary profession about how to deal with this problem. Again, we're not alone in Oregon. Veterinarians and the American Veterinary Colleges are trying to figure out how to stop this shortage and to reverse the trend. And time and again, focus groups, committees have come up with the best way to deal with this is student loan repayment or compensation for that. And that's why I was very pleased to see this bill be introduced, and I hope that we can help our graduates.
Thank you, Ed. And correct me if I'm wrong, but you threw a statistic out there that kind of very much 80% of your students are women. Is that a national trend?
That's right. That it is. It's it reflects, and it varies around that a little bit. But I would say for the last 10 years, I've been at Oregon State for 13 years now, and it's been about 75% to 80% women. That reflects both the numbers of people that apply to the program and those that are accepted, and that's pretty much nationwide.
Wow. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Oh. Hello, my name is Sharon Harmon. I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Humane Society. We are not affiliated with any local or national humane organization.
But you have a 501c3.
You're right. Thank you. Anyone else want to fill in? I have a script. Okay. You could read from it, just in case. We're here to support this bill because we believe the best thing for animals is to have professional medical care. And without veterinarians, people are left to their own devices, and there are some things you should not try at home on your own, and veterinary medicine is one of them. We have a partnership, the Oregon Humane Society and Oregon State University. All veterinary students, fourth-year students, come through our shelter, our veterinary hospital. It's a required course, and they spend 2 weeks there. And they get a lot of experience. They graduate spaying 40 to 60 cats and dogs and see all kinds of things and all the animals that come through our care. One of my pleasures is I get to have lunch with the new students every 2 weeks. And 80%, you would know, absolutely. But 80% seems low. I look around the table, and when there's a guy, we note it, because there isn't. And we ask him at the start, what are you going to do? What are you going to go off and practice, and where do you want to practice? And it's very few. This is all purely anecdotal. It's very few that say, I want to go into food animal medicine in a distant part of the state where I don't have to talk to people. They want to work with companion animals, and I'd like to think that after going through our program, they really want to work with companion animals. But it's not a job that women coming out of college are going to grasp onto. Yet, if we're going to continue to care for large numbers of animals in confined operations, we need to have medical professionals with all the skills to help preserve the quality of life for those animals and to preserve the safety of people along the way. So we see this bill as a way to support the veterinary community and keep rural communities intact with veterinary services. Thank you.
Representative Shaw.
Thank you. You know, my daughter, like every kid, has went through various occupations of interest, you know, and she talked about being a veterinarian, and then she watches Animal Planet all the time. And she goes, oh, Dad, I don't think I can, you know, the pain and suffering. She loves it. You know, when they're cured, it's great, but that's a great show, by the way. But Ms. Harmon, you commented about don't try this at home, but I was in a meeting the other night about gravel and farmland, and there was a sheep farmer, a woman, and she's going to start having lambs soon. Yeah. And she was talking about when they have twins or triplets, or if there's this one come, she literally does what I think a veterinarian would do. It moves them around, shifts them around, pulls them out, and there's ranchers and farmers pulling calves all the time. So out in these hinterlands like Malheur County, I imagine the farmer is the veterinarian. The rancher is the veterinarian, does do a lot of this themselves, and with, I hope, the technical support of a veterinarian. But I did not realize that it was such a gender-specific trend of women becoming, and that's a good thing, but it's surprising.
Okay.
Well, Mr. Chair, may I comment on something that Representative Roblin had said earlier when he discussed? You know, there is a dollar amount attached to this, so I'm assuming it will eventually referred to Ways and Means. But if there is some chance, if the funding is not available, and we understand of the difficult times, that support for the bill can be passed without that funding to have a placement, that this is a program, a concept that we do like, I think that would be very, very helpful.
So you strip anything out of the bill, still pass the bill, it goes straight to the floor.
If it comes down to that, yes.
Okay, I understand.
If it were to come down to that.
Okay, I think I'll excuse this panel, get our next three up here.
That's how he was born.
What would come along?
So how about we have, so we don't have odd numbers in the next one, Vicki and Rachel from the Student Assistance Commission. After that, we'll have Sean Cleave and Roger Breyer. I shouldn't tell particularly Representative Gilliam this, but just so you all know, in the audience today is a constituent of mine. I think do we have others from the ICL here, Gordon? Do we have others from ICL? Okay. So, Willamette University has the Institute of Continued Learning, and it's where, there's an age limit, you'd be over a certain age, is that the way it works?
Over
85. Over 80? Oh, no, it's not, Dr. Haney, come on. I tried to ask if I'd get in, I know I couldn't. Anyway, retirees, I think in general, they take classes in Willamette, all kinds of topics, all kinds of things. Today, they had the misfortune to come watch me chair committee and see us today on how committees in the legislature work. So they're here just not lobbying, they're just learning and observing more about the process, and they've witnessed all this. And they're going to continue witnessing this for a while longer.
Mr. Chair, I had the pleasure, and forgive me for not remembering your name, sir, of meeting Janet Atkins' husband this morning is in the crowd. And if anybody knows how committees and this legislature work, it is Janet. She was the best, no offense to present company, the best committee administrator in the state of Oregon, bar none. And I just wanted to recognize him out there. So I'm pretty sure he has a good resource.
For the record, Gordon the Cool Fool Osborne.
I wasn't pointing at Gordon.
Right.
Pointing at the guy right behind
him. I know, I'm sorry, I thought you were, I apologize, you're not the cool fool. You are. Yes, thank you. Okay. Now, before we start, I just want you all to know that Vicki Merkel invented the Aspire program herself.
Wow.
And then built it and made it happen. We all finally blessed it and gave it some money. But that is just one tiny example of her ability to in-state government for three decades now. You wouldn't know it from her youthful appearance, but invent innovative programs that have helped thousands of people around the state. So she's probably now mad at me, but you know what? I have a gavel, and you haven't gotten to talk yet, and she's wonderful
And I used to chair the Student Assistance Commission, and so I have fond affection for this agency, but particularly her. Thank you. Representative Roland.
I might as well just climb on, because when she came to Marshall High School and helped with our start of our Aspire program, Vicki is probably one of the best teachers in the state of Oregon. Taught me a lot. I think taught all the people in our community how those kinds of assistance programs with volunteers can work, should work, and the only way they should work. So if anybody ever out there is listening to any of this has to start a volunteer program, Vicki's the person to get a hold of. There wasn't another program close. So, and I agree. That's why I agree with that.
Excellent example of a public servant. So with that, hi.
Good morning, Chair Klim, members of the committee. My name is Vicki Merkel, embarrassed Vicki Merkel, perhaps I should say. I am the Scholarship and Access Program Director at the Oregon Student Assistance Commission, and I have with me today Rachel Cummings, who's the Portfolio Coordinator, who administers the Rural Health Program and other repayment and loan forgiveness programs. And I do thank you for those kind words, both Representative Klim and Representative Roblin. And it is an honor to work at the Oregon Student Assistance Commission, and I don't mean to be corny, but it is a wonderful organization that is small but mighty, and we do lots of things that are, with intention, creative and a little different, and then some things, like a program like this, that you really can't figure out where else it might go. if you do find another home for it, we'll still be happy about that, but I just am here to testify a little bit about our understanding of how the administration of this project would work. We understand that this is a loan repayment program for veterinarians, as you've heard, in veterinary resource shortage areas. I want to be real clear that we're understanding that the awarding consideration is defined to individuals who are in their last year of a veterinary medical program or not more than 3 years from having graduated. They have to have had loans for tuition, education, living expenses that are not in default, have not received any other repayment assistance, and agree to provide veterinary services in a shortage area for at least 2 years. Our reading of the bill then would be that awards would be made during this time period, the service is then completed, and then the funds are dispersed. Sometimes there's confusion between a loan forgiveness program and a loan repayment program. We're reading this to be a loan repayment program. A loan forgiveness program, which I don't want to belabor because I don't want to confuse you, and it sounds like a good thing, but it's really difficult for students. That's where the agency becomes the lender, and students have to agree to do a service, and then if they life takes them in a different direction, then we become a collections agency to get the money back. So we're reading this as a repayment program. The students are awarded. They go out into the shortage areas. They complete their service, and then we disperse the funding. Well, we should note that OSAC has a history in collaborating with professional organizations and colleges to put together a selection committee. We may not be experts in large animal veterinary medicine, but we know how to find those people and bring them together to administer the program. In our experience with a similar program, if you've been talking about the Rural Health Services Program, in the 13 years that OSAC has been administering that program, we've only had one practitioner who did not fulfill their commitment and did have penalties and have to repay. So I thought you might find that interesting. Mm-hmm. Thanks for the opportunity to speak today. If you have any questions for either Rachel or myself, we'd be happy to answer them.
Representative Byer.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah. I mean that stepping out for a minute, but when you say you only had one person that didn't fulfill their commitment, do you have a ballpark idea of how many people have accessed this program? Mm-hmm.
I'd 123.
Do we have to have Rachel?
Yeah, Rachel, could you just identify?
Oh, I'm sorry. Here? I'm Rachel Cummings, Chair Klim, and members of the committee.
With the
organization. Yeah, we've had about 123. Some have forfeited, or some fulfill their obligation. And
thank you.
How many applicants do you have each year?
Okay.
We have a lot of applicants per year. Vicki asked me how many applicants we have each year, but we have a lot of interest, and people call from all over the country interested in the Oregon Rural Health Loan Repayment Program.
Yeah. All right, thank you very much. Why don't I get Sean Cleave and Roger Byer up to
Now, this is the first time I've had Sean Cleave in front of my committee. This could be good. Oh, I should have thought more about this in advance. Okay, welcome.
For the record, Sean Cleave, representing the Oregon Farm Bureau. It is my first time in front of your committee chair, Clem. I'm filling in for Katie, so any details can be punted to her. I'd just like to, for the record, state that Oregon Farm Bureau supports this bill. There are quite a few farmers and ranchers in eastern Oregon that can attest to the lack of veterinarian profession in eastern Oregon. So with that, I'll wrap up my testimony. I will state, since Roger's not here, he did ask that the Oregon dairyman be stated for the record in support of this measure as well.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Gill?
Just to be sure, he's referring to Roger Beyer. He said Roger.
Right.
Yes,
Roger
Beyer.
Roger that, Representative Gill.
Thank you.
Very good.
Okay. Any questions for our friend from the Farm Bureau?
He's killing me.
I guess you're excused.
All right, thanks.
And Representative Roblin.
I think the amendments are good. And it is $20,000, the maximum amount you could give a person back, but that we still didn't set the amount of money that we are. We don't necessarily have the money to do all of them. So generally put a funding amount that will fund it for $400,000 or $300,000. Sometimes you don't have enough to pay all the people you'd like, and that's the kind of conversation we still need to have.
They have waiting lists or things.
But like I would that. Still say that $20,000 should be the maximum amount that any one person could receive over the period of time. That's just helpful.
And we don't, Mr. Chair, and we don't have even a thumbnail 20K times
X number yet. Not there right now, okay. In this way it's written.
We don't have a fiscal either
right.
For that reason. And actually, you know, this one was the one I was thinking about why we're holding it back to weight against other things. So it sounds like we would have an option if we decide we can't send it to Ways and Means to still advance it as a policy in the state. The other one technically is sent over to revenue, I think, actually.
Correct.
And I don't remember the speaker saying we weren't allowed to just pass the buck and send things over to revenue. So maybe we'll get some of
it. Mr. Chair, I would take a close look at that relating clause before you send it.
We're going to have ICL folks, we'll talk about all this and after the meeting and how our crazy inside humor, legislative humor. With that, I'm going to close the public hearing. We have no further folks on this, unless there's someone in the audience who wants to weigh in on this. That's House Bill 2574. I'm closing the public hearing. And I'm going to announce that there is a Thursday evening meeting. So we're not meeting Thursday in the morning, and we're meeting Thursday to hear from Oregon's hunters about the state of the sport.
In the evening, Representative?
In the evening.
What time is that?
5:30.
Okay.
And I'm going to stay until I get kicked out, but you're not required to do so.
Right here in the Capitol, sir.
Right? Yeah, right here. We'll get a hearing room to you. Representative Roblin, then Representative Roblin.
I just wanted to thank you for a day at the legislature for Representative Roblin. Couldn't have been arranged better for me, so thanks for having it all.
Representative Gilliam.
I move that the chair provide food and drink for the evening session.
Out of order. Representative Van Orden.
Well, thank you, Chair Clem. I guess Representative Gilliam strikes again. Or strikes out.
Strikes out again.
I would like to comment on the last bill that came before us, simply because, for me, it's just a lamentable situation, because this isn't the only group that's coming and asking for some dispensation for the cost of education, cost of higher education. And I just think it's lamentable that our kids are saddled with such huge debt just so that they can have a degree to be productive members of our society. And I just think we have continually shortchanged our society by not recognizing the tremendous burden they carry.
Well, one comment I might make on that note is, you know, Oregon has made significant advances in helping with financial aid. We went from, we were down to almost as low as $33 million at one point was a projected budget for the two-year period for the Oregon Opportunity Grant back in about 01, 02 when we were cutting mid-year. And now we're at $104 million with, potential to either, we don't know what's going to happen this session, but that's a tripling.
in just 4 or 5 years. Now, having said that, not eligible for your graduate school. So wouldn't help here. I actually, again, might be just a policy discussion, but I do have a bill in that says if we ever can take care of the waiting list at the undergraduate level, that we would change the statute to allow for, after everybody else is covered part-time and full-time undergrad, to get into graduate-level work. But that's a longer-term conversation for the state. But one way we go about reducing debt level is, you know, keeping tuition down, that kind of thing. The other way is helping with financial aid in the back end. And the state has done phenomenally well in the last 4 or 5 years, so I at least want to get that out there.
And, Mr. Chair, you know, if they stay in the state and live, we get a return on our investment.
Yeah. That's right.
A huge return on our
income taxes right off the bat. Representative Roper.
And I want to concur with that. I think we have started to make the gains. But at the core, we also, in my opinion, have not been funding universities at the basic level. Not the reason they keep raising the tuition is because we haven't helped in other ways that many other states do. And the university system is... We do not put a lot of our resources in the university system as many other states do. And I think what we've all known is the return on investment and the people being educated here stay here. We're going to have to keep looking at that and rethinking what our total investment in higher ed is going to be if we want to keep the state growing.
I mean, we're drifting towards a high tuition, high aid state, right. And without that being the policy. We have a low tuition policy on the books. It's just
right.
Okay, with that,
Mr. Chair, I just wanted to say that no wonder everybody wants their bills here, because they probably figured that we're going to get to the discussion at some point anyway.
I see all members. That's an admonishment from a committee chair of great stature there that we are off topic slightly. I'm going to close the hearing.